KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Saturday marks 1 year since a fire that killed 36 people broke out during a party at the Ghost Ship Warehouse in Oakland. Coming up on Forum, we talk with members of the artistic community affected by the fire about life after the tragedy. And we'll check in with city officials about the changing landscape for artists, musicians, and people living in non-traditional housing in Oakland. It's all next after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. On December 2nd, last year, a fire broke out at a party at a warehouse in Oakland known as Ghost Ship. 36 people died in the fire. A shattering loss for the artistic community that lived and congregated at the warehouse and for Oakland as a whole. And joining us first to talk about the tragedy 1 year later are here in studio, Nihar Bhatt, who's a DJ with the San Francisco Surface Tension Collective. He witnessed the fire and lost seven friends in the blaze. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Glad to have you back. We also have Sinuba Dream with us, an artist and musician who lost a lot of friends in the Ghost Ship fire. Involved with the group Safer DIY Spaces, which advocates for non-traditional living in art spaces, and welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. And Sinuba, let me begin with you. Let's just talk about what you reflect on a year later. The tragedy I know still cleaves, I'm sure, to you. In deep emotional ways because you lost people you love, but there's much to celebrate in their memories and there's much to remember.
Yeah. I guess a year later, it's still hard to go to shows, but a lot of those people were very encouraging to me to continue to make art and helped me actually perform live for the first time. So I just try to remember that and keep doing what I do.
You still feel that there's hope for this whole world of art that existed, art and music, that was almost emblematic of what the warehouse held in Oakland?
I guess for a year it's felt more and more hopeless, but doing work with Safer DIY Spaces has helped me a lot.
Tell us about that work.
We're just a group that started right after the fire, kind of in a lot of manic energy, and there were a lot of people, and now it's just down to about five of us, but we pretty much are a liaison between very traumatized artists who are live in these types of warehouses that were affected by the fire in the city, and yeah.
Moving on with your lives.
Trying.
Yeah. And Nihar, what about you? What do you reflect on a year later?
You know, as the anniversary approaches, it's been kind of ironic that it's been surfacing more because for me and a lot of the people around me, and I'm sure Sinuba can agree with this, there hasn't been a day that's gone by that I haven't sort of had the first thought I woke up with be about the fire and sort of, you know, it's really at the forefront of my mind every day. And when I think about it, you know, any recent memory I've had, or any memory I think about, the first thing I think about is, did this happen before or after the fire? Or did this happen at a time when these people were with us or after?
It's become the marker of your life in many ways.
Absolutely. Right? You know, I think, you know, I sometimes think that it's sort of maybe it'll be the last thing I ever think about, you know, because it's such a huge thing. And it's still very surreal. You know, it doesn't feel like it was a year ago. It feels like this just happened. And that's really the feeling, you know, I carry with me every day. And I'm not alone, for sure. I think when I say that out loud, a lot of people nod in agreement. And it's something that, it's not surprising. It's such a, it's still pretty surreal.
What do you think about or feel about when the whole question comes up about the future of artists living and working the way, essentially, as I said, Ghost Ship was at least intended to be?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are massive challenges that face artists today. You know, the conditions that led to the Ghost Ship tragedy are one of the things that is huge, which the one of the primary conditions being the massive housing crisis and crisis of space, crisis of resources that artists face in the modern world. I think that people will find a way to make it happen, but will the spaces and the places that they're able to perform or perform art, will those places be safe? Will those places be, you know, filled with human contact? Will people be relegated to sort of social media and sort of isolation, alienation? You know, that's what places like this gave people.
Those are the big questions, indeed. Yeah. Well, we asked some questions along those lines to Mayor Libby Schaff. I spoke with her earlier today by phone and asked her about her thoughts also on this somber anniversary. Let's hear.
Well, it is a somber time, and it's a time to reflect not just on the heartbreaking loss from last year, but all the work, all the ways that we've honored those memories by working to be better, be safer, but also to honor the incredible creative community that Oakland is so blessed to have.
There's a lot of concern that that creative community may be in dire straits and really might not find not only the residences or the places where they can continue the creative outlet that we've seen in the past, but are being displaced as we speak.
That is a real fear, and we in city government share it. We are working so hard to try and balance all the competing interests that we must balance. You know, we can never turn a blind eye to life safety. If there's one lesson from this tragedy, obviously the laws that are in place to ensure safety matter tremendously. But we've really tried to take more of a case management approach to our enforcement work as we really think about the needs of tenants, as we work as more creative problem solvers. But it is hard to do that in the face of unbelievable Bay Area market forces where real estate values in Oakland have gone up so much. Obviously, vigilance with this kind of risk has gone up so much with landlords. And then there are new types of very profitable uses of spaces that used to be used for the creative community, like the cannabis cultivation business. So these are all the factors that we grapple with. We have incredibly competent, talented, and compassionate public servants in Oakland, and I know you're going to hear from some of them later, that have been just really grappling with how we balance these competing interests.
Well, I read the executive report that was put out, actually an anniversary update and progress report, and your executive order. And I'm wondering, there were a number of things that were focused on, a number of things that showed real attempts to move forward and progress that was made. But what particularly do you still have to work on the most? What do you feel is really wanting here?
I think the next big changes are changes in our event permitting system. While we recognize a need to change laws, sometimes we recognize that we need to make it easier for people to comply with our laws and use our systems like permitting. So that is a big one that still is in front of us. And the other one is changes to the building code. Now, these have sparked some real passionate debates about kind of what are responsible changes that take into effect the different types of uses that are not traditional, but that are really going to encourage the community of artists to be able to thrive in Oakland, but without really sacrificing safety. But we do see some potential for changes, not just locally, but possibly at the state level, that we think could go a long ways to finding that good balance.
Could I also ask you, before we say goodbye on this anniversary, whether you have anything to say to the young artists in Oakland or those who want to at least continue to work in Oakland as artists?
We value this community so much. I almost get teased for talking about Oakland's secret sauce constantly. And artists and creative energy is always one of the first things we all talk about when we talk about Oakland's uniqueness and its value. We are struggling to protect this community and other vulnerable communities in the face of what is an unprecedented housing crisis that the entire Bay Area is suffering from. And I just have to say that as public servants, we are all just deeply scarred by living through this horrific tragedy, and that we are working hard every day, as Oaklanders do, with compassion and creativity to push to new solutions that take into account not just our responsibilities around safety, but also to create security of housing and to nurture the incredible creative energy that Oakland is so proud to be home to.
I hope you can find those solutions and that the city of Oakland can indeed benefit from them. And Mayor Schaaf, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
That was Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf. We spoke earlier this morning, and also with us this morning here in studios, Matthias Gaffney. He's an investigative reporter for the East Bay Times. He was part of the Pulitzer Prize-winning team that covered the Ghost Ship fire. Welcome, Matthias.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to get your response to Mayor Schaaf, but first, can you give us an update just on, well, I know that Derek Almena and Max Harris both been pleading not guilty, both in prison and have been charged. And there's a whole question at this point about others being charged. What's the status first of those two?
Yeah, so they are still in custody. They're awaiting a preliminary hearing. They've been charged with 36 counts of involuntary manslaughter for their roles in the fire. That case has been moving slowly through the court system. There's also, in conjunction with that, civil lawsuits filed by victims and victim families. That's also kind of meandering through the courts right now. There hasn't been much major, you know, the preliminary hearing is going to be the first major step where we get a lot of new evidence and we find out a lot more about what exactly happened that night.
There was a ruling by the Alameda Superior Court judge, however, that the city could be liable.
Yeah, I mean, there's cities in general, there's a lot of immunity. It takes a lot to overcome that immunity, but the judge allowed them to stay as defendants in this case. And, you know, we've done a lot of reporting over the last year that showed a number of red flags over the last months since the Ghost Ship fire of where different city departments were alerted to issues at this warehouse and few actions were taken.
Well, Derek Almena, who was sort of the tenant in charge, I mean, I guess that would be the most expressive title, has said there are a lot of other people to blame. There were 20 artists. There's PG&E. He even said God. And then he said, well, that's maybe ridiculous. But are there more people that really need to be brought to justice here?
I know a lot of people
or organizations like PG&E for that
matter. This is a unique case. You know, you see like the Las Vegas shooting, or you see, you know, a terrorist act, and there's malicious acts there, right? You're trying to kill other people. I don't think anyone's going to argue that no one here was trying to get anyone killed. What was there negligence? Absolutely. You could tell the cluttered space, you know, the lack of, you know, ingress from the building, the owners who knew of an electrical problem but didn't do anything about it. Bottom line, there's a lot of blame to go around to a lot of different people. And the issue that we're talking about is the court system on what you can prove and can't prove. And to this point, we only have Derek and Max Harris being charged. There's a lot of people who want to see the owner of the building, Shor Ng, get charged. That hasn't happened yet. The DA's office hasn't said they definitely won't. They say it's still kind of ongoing. But other than that, criminally speaking, no one has really been, you know, under investigation that we can find out.
I want to get your response, Matthias, also to what we heard from Mayor Schaaf. But there's also, since you mentioned landlords, there's a good deal of unwillingness on the part of a lot of landlords to agree with these compliance plans, isn't it?
Well, I think that's going to be one of the major factors here. And frankly, the mayor has told us as much, that they're getting very little cooperation. There's literally been one landlord who's been brought under by the city to get up to code, who has participated in the city's program. And that we spoke to him, and he's incredibly frustrated. He says the rules change. There's different goals, and they move all the time. And at the same time, I think part of the crux of the problem is these landlords are probably not going to participate because you know, if they throw in all this money that the city is asking them to do to upgrade these places, are they going to still offer, you know, the rents to these people, to these artists, and oftentimes to these vulnerable communities? Are the rents going to stay that low? Where, if you spruce it up, now, you know, are you able to charge, you know, market rate and start driving out some of those people who maybe couldn't afford it earlier?
Well, I was reading an architect by the name of Thomas Dolan, whom you may be familiar with, Oakland architect. He said between the pot industry, the tech industry, and code enforcement, it may be the end of artist-occupied warehouses and artist-occupied the sort of secret sauce that Mayor Schaff was talking about.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't mean to be gloomy about this, but, you know, realistically, there's, in fact, there was a story about another supposedly an architect who was going in to check codes in one of the warehouses that was being turned into a residential place. And the reality was he left his briefcase and it turned out he was a developer. I mean, these kind of stories are rife. Now, there are a lot of people who see money here.
Yes. I mean, you're talking, let's take Ghost Ship for an example. You have essentially an absentee landlord who is saying that she didn't know that anyone was living in there, right? Yet still collecting rent from a tenant. So, you know, what if that, if it, it, you know, this is a building that's essentially a warehouse and has been, the tenants have made it what they will out of it, right? It's, the onus is on those tenants to keep it safe in a situation like that. And so that's the balance as the city is trying to find, you know, how much do we want to ensure that these places are safe, and how much do we want to require these landlords to make these changes to building codes and these changes to safety standards to meet these responsibilities that we have? And then if we go too far, are we going to price these people out? And are they going to get kicked out? Are they going to get evicted? Are they going to be looking for new spaces? Are they going to go back underground? If now that they've spent this money to landlords and they want to raise the rents, then we're back to square one.
Well, they have to get up to code with not only sprinklers and seismic things and so forth, but the rent goes up as a result. Let me ask Sunuba and Nihar, Sunuba Dream and Nihar Bhatt, who are both here in studio with us, both artists. Either of you or both of you, what are you hearing about people being displaced?
Could I just say one quick thing on the compliance plans with the city? As somebody whose warehouse is getting inspected, I just have to say the city doesn't help you make a compliance plan at all. I've been working with DIY Safety, and we went with building plans, and they're just like, oh, you guys need to figure out what to do, and then we'll approve it. So I don't think landlords aren't coming forward. It's just that they're afraid, and the executive order isn't truly being followed. It's like, yeah, there are suggestions, but the actual culture of the building inspectors hasn't changed. So
you're getting frustrated on that score. But what about just what you sense about people being displaced? I mean, can you address that if you would?
One thing to note is
Nihar.
On the official records, I think that there are 5 code enforcement based evictions, but the reality is, according to the journalist Sam Lefebvre, who did some digging, you know, he's found at least 10 evictions that actually happened, and then and I believe DIY Safe Spaces predicts that there are probably more like 15 spaces, who've been displaced since the fire because of code enforcement related investigations. What's happening despite the ordinance, you know, despite the executive order, despite a lot of the talk of wanting to move on code changes, the fact is that things have gotten worse, and the atmosphere is still one in which displacement is happening on a regular basis. It's not entirely market-based. It's also a situation where the city could be moving faster.
Well, there's a lot of tension between tenants and inspectors, and let me actually bring William Gilchrist into this. I said I'd like to hear from him. He's a planning and building director for the city of Oakland. William Gilchrist, welcome to Forum. Good to have you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning to you. Can you talk about this tension that's going on right now between tenants and inspectors?
Well, I'll talk about it. I just want to make sure that everyone's also aware of the frame I'm approaching this through. I've arrived in September, and this is certainly among the most important issues that was presented, you know, before me coming into this position. And I certainly have had an opportunity, both through engagement with constituent groups around this issue outside City Hall and also going through our processes relative to code enforcement of this particular building type and looking at this constituent of residents, to know that there is a real concern here, both in terms of the market aspects that have been brought up, the very high price point pushes of real estate and affordability.
But excuse me, a lot of the code enforcement in these buildings, the buildings aren't even designed for residential use, are they?
No, and that's really the issue, is that we're trying to get an alignment where the safety of the buildings will really support the residency and the mixed uses. And what's interesting, I think there was a point made earlier, perhaps you had made it, that we're also looking to some extent at a new typology of residence, that we're looking at warehouses where they're both being used for fabrication or assembly uses at the same time being used as residences. So it's almost a dormitory model of sorts. And I listened to one of the, I think, points being made earlier by one of the guests about finding a way to work through code interpretation or code adjustments to be able to address this burgeoning typology. And one of the things that we have on the near-term horizon over the next several months is to look specifically at what code amendments and code changes might happen. And also, even in terms of current code requirements, are there different paths to get to compliance that might not be as onerous on the cost of retrofit or system improvement? And this is an interesting challenge. Cities across America are dealing with many issues of displacement as cities are being rediscovered as preferred locations in metro areas to live. The Bay Area is certainly unique in terms of the acceleration of price points because of that interest coming in. So this is set in the context of a broader housing challenge that we have in Oakland, in particular in the Bay Area in general.
Let me ask you to hold your thoughts for a moment, because we're coming up on a break, and I'm actually looking at a tweet here that said, building codes are useless with no enforcement, but I'd like to speak some more with you and also with our guests here in studio. And when we return, we'd also like to speak with you, our listeners, and get your thoughts about this 1 year after the remembering today of the Oakland Ghost Ship Fire and what it means for Oakland's future, and particularly for the artists and young people in Oakland. And in fact, we're going to go out here with some music. Nihar, you got a whole kind of music archive here that's giving memory and so forth. We're going to hear Jimmy Egaz. Can you tell us a little bit about him as we go? Johnny Egaz, excuse me.
Oh, Johnny Egaz. Johnny Egaz, his artist's name was Knocked, and he was an incredibly inspiring figure in San Francisco and Oakland, sort of house and techno scenes. And he has a release coming out on my label Left Hand Path that I run with Chris Zaldúa. And it's called Private Property Creative.
Yeah, let me go back to that when we come back. We're going to give the number, though, first, because listeners may want to join us. It's toll-free. You can do it now at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website, kqed.org/forum. That's an untitled track by Obsidian Blade, which was the main musical project of Joey Cascio, another victim of the fire. And this will also be released on vinyl and digital by Left Hand Path in early 2018. I want to invite our listeners to join in this discussion. You may want to reflect on the fire a year after the Oakland Ghost Ship Fire. That's what we're doing. And also bring your memories and your thoughts. It may be a marker for you, as it is for Nihar Bhatt, who's here with us in studio, along with Sunuba Dream and Matthias Gaffney. And if you have some reflections and thoughts, we'd like to hear them. Or if you have some memories of the Oakland artistic community or were a part of it or have some thoughts about where it's all headed, we'd like to hear those thoughts from you as well. How have things developed since the fire? Well, we're certainly focusing or trying to focus as well on housing issues and evictions that are going on and displacement and the concerns of housing that are central to this whole issue. And if you'd like to join us, you can do that now at our toll-free number. Let me give it to you again. It's 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786, or email thoughts, questions, comments, reflections to forum@kqed.org, or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. And Gerald writes, I know of at least one local performance series that's ended because their papers weren't in order. It's a shame and a sign that local authorities ought better understand that not all dodgy spaces are dangerous and that art especially may need to be done on the cheap. Can I get you to respond to that, William Gilchrist?
Well, I would need to know more about the specific case, but if I can put that in the frame of the conversation we were having before the break. Again, we're looking at some typology of uses, the mixing of residences with performing spaces, with creative venues, that we really have to review through code and see if we can actually establish a category of compliance that it fits within its own box, its own parameter. I think given the fact, and you raised the point earlier, that this is a different type of habitation for the buildings from the building's original intended use, we're having to apply codes that address a category of building that, in fact, they were not originally intended to look at. So one of the things that we'll be doing in addition to addressing code adaptation or different ways to get to compliance is to work with the state and work with other local agents to see if there's a way we might be able to pull together some resources for property owners who are looking to comply to bring their buildings in line and revolving loans, things of that nature. Because you all have made excellent points prior to my joining the conversation of where the parameters of this lie. Safety for the residents and the occupants of the building, first and foremost. Understanding, given the housing crisis, that we're looking at having to adapt all sorts of building stock to accommodate affordability. And the third is to make sure that we can get an alignment among all the participants involved, the tenants, the property owners, and the official enforcement agents, to be able to address this issue, and again, in a way that is safe for the occupants who are there, but also recognize the different lifestyle and needs and approaches that we have in this community. And again, as someone who has recently come into Oakland, and I come out of a city where culture is an absolutely critical aspect of its vibrance and its identity, this is something I am very devoted towards following up on.
Again, we're talking to members of the Oakland artistic community and officials 1 year after the Ghost Ship fire, and we do want to hear from you and how things have changed for you. Could I also ask you, William Gilchrist, about, and I'll go to Matthias on this too, there's an anonymous complaint line that's been set up, and actually, Matthias, I get a comment from you on this. There have been some talk about a lot of grudges and political adversaries using this line and so forth. But first, from you, William Gilchrist, I mean, how useful has that been?
A grudge line?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's been talk about at least the anonymous line being used for grudges or for political purposes and so forth. I mean, if there's been follow through from the city on the line, I wonder if that's been a concern or a problem or a challenge.
Well, it's not one that I've encountered yet, but now that you have brought that forward, I'll do a little bit of digging. You mean in the context of people bringing forward issues that either speak specifically to residential adaptation or just using the line for other purposes?
No, for you using it for other purposes, right.
Oh, I see. Well, all I can say is that since I have arrived here, we've been very focused on this particular concern. And if there are other uses in terms of the line, I think we're probably sieving those so we can really keep our eye on the prize.
You shed some light here, Matthias?
Yeah, I mean, my colleague and I, Aaron, we very early on began looking right after the Ghost Ship fire. We started looking at this hotline because, you know, frankly, you could get access to these complaints online. And we found very quickly that, you know, you'd see people, neighbors, you know, quote unquote, ratting out their neighbors saying, you know, there's a Ghost Ship situation, you know, Ghost Ship, the name Ghost Ship's getting brought up into all these complaints saying here. And I think we now, as we're approaching a 1 year anniversary, we took a look at all those complaints and we found that there was about 70 complaints for warehouses, churches, storefronts, that type, and about 140 complaints for homes and apartments where there's like someone has a converted garage or something like that. And so, you know, I think there was a bit of hysteria immediately after Ghost Ship where, you know, you see your neighbor and there's some questionable activity, maybe people coming at night, and you immediately think there's another, you know, warehouse that's going to go up in flames. And I think maybe there was some places that deserve some additional attention, but I also think there was a lot of people who maybe had prior bones to pick with a neighbor and maybe wanted to, you know, use the ghost ship tragedy as a way to, you know, push them out. We saw a lot of different cases like that, and it's still ongoing, but it was definitely a really prevalent right after the tragedy.
Well, William Gilchrist,
if I may, I understand. Now I have a better sense now of what you're talking about. Thank you, sir, for that explanation. And the only thing I can say, and I'll be very brief about it, is that regrettably, regulations relating to land use and property are often used that way, and not just about fire safety or life safety, but also about zoning setbacks. I have worked in many cities, and regrettably, you do have some of our citizens, some of our residents who will use these regulations because there is some other issue in play. And it's just up to us to be able to separate the substantive ones from ones that are coming from that motivation.
And again, William Gilchrist is Planning and Building Director of the City of Elko. Could I ask you one more question? I know you have to leave, but I'd like your thoughts about some concerns that have been expressed about the mayor's order, which allegedly said to put emphasis on not displacing residents, but there's been concern about that being ignored, even when apparently there were no life-saving risks involved. And we're getting displacement, in other words, supposedly when displacement is not in order.
No, I've heard that, and again, it is a major concern, both around the nexus of addressing life safety, but also understanding that we have an affordability crisis, particularly for our creative communities. The reason to get into the code again is to look at some means of addressing the life safety considerations that will work within the affordability locus of property owners or building owners. To the extent that there is a critical concern of safety during current occupancy, that has to be addressed. And the hope is, of course, that an owner will be compliant and will be able to align. To the extent, again, that we can come with an affordable path of safety for residents, and, as I mentioned before, looking at revolving loans, looking at opportunities to address state law, where we can assist in compliance and bringing those buildings into compliance, that's really where our focus is going to be. I am getting very, very familiar, obviously, with the frontline operations of inspection and enforcement. And the realignment of culture within inspection services is something that you know, we're going to have to bring into this conversation in real time. And as we look at code adaptations, as we look at opportunities to really be able to address both the economics and the residency alignment here, the code officials are going to have to be very engaged in that conversation. They have to be in the tent as we discuss this. And the only other thing I'd like to mention is, having worked in other cities, there's always an issue around the different constituents of code compliance, both inside city governance and outside. I have been very impressed upon my arrival in Oakland with the measures that have been taken to date, particularly between the fire department and the building bureau, to work through this case management approach where we're really trying to unpack these cases that we see around compliance and see if there are ways to get to yes. But this is going to be very good information for us to use as far as test cases of alternative approaches for code alignment. We'll also be looking at different opportunities around designation of buildings, around preservation, et cetera, to see if there's some better paths for us to get to yes around code compliance as well for our historic buildings that are being adaptively reused.
Well, let me wish you good fortune, and thank you for joining us this morning, William Gilchrist.
Yes, so thank you very much for including me, and thank you very much to the participants who have been involved in this, and we look forward to working together with all of you.
Again, our thanks to William Gilchrist, who is Planning and Building Director of the City of Oakland. A couple of comments coming in, then I want to go to your calls. Ivan writes, as an Oakland artist and ex-art space owner, I think Mayor Libby Schaaf is full of it. The Oakland government has only put superficial Band-Aids on the problems. She pretends she has little influence against market forces. It's the government's responsibility to keep living here affordable. And Kyle writes, regulations are not the only issue. Artists wouldn't be living in warehouse conditions if they had affordable housing in the Bay Area. Regulations are not enforced either, but why should a fire code inspector expect people to live or perform somewhere they legally can't? Let me go to our callers, and let's go first to San Francisco caller Tom. You're on the air.
Yeah, what happened to the landlord?
What happened to the landlord?
Yeah, the landlord.
If you're asking why a landlord isn't on this panel, it's because we wanted a couple of artists and we got them, and we wanted to remember things, and we didn't want to get in the old debates that we could get in and have been involved in and embroiled in the past. But I thank you for the call. We've certainly heard the landlord's voices before, and you're welcome to call in here, by the way. You've talked to the landlords, though, haven't you, Matthias?
Yeah, we've talked to landlords. I don't know if he was specifically speaking about the ghost ship landlord, Chor Ng, but she's been very elusive into talking to her attorneys, won't talk to us.
I thought he was asking why weren't landlords on this panel, but he was asking about the Ng family, the owners of the building.
Perhaps. He may have been both.
Sure. But let's take up the subject of landlords, though, generally, though. I mean, what have you...
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken to them, and the ones who are trying to abide by these new rules are saying it's moving targets. They say that the city tells them to do one thing, and then they're told to do another thing. They're told that they're having to put in like plumbing and you know insulation for stuff, and so it's moved a little bit away from fire safety, they're saying, into other types of compliances, and it's just adding more and more costs for them. And then, as the city has said, that there's many who either aren't getting on board for one reason or another.
I wasn't clear, but apparently that listener wanted to know what happened to the landlord. I mean, in this case of the ghost ship.
Yeah, and she hasn't been charged, Chor Ng, nor her family. You know, we uncovered.
Already put that on the record.
Here. Yeah, and we you know, in our reporting over the year, we had internal emails from tenants to the family saying that there's electrical issues at this warehouse, and yet nothing was done to make those fixes.
They haven't talked to you in the press either, have they?
They've talked in very early on. They essentially said they didn't know anyone was living in the warehouse.
Oh. Okay, let me go to another caller here. Let's get Della on next. Della, you're on.
Hi, thank you so much for this program. I have a couple things. I was thinking about this as I was listening to everyone, and I was thinking about the core root of the problem, and I don't know if anyone has really discussed this, but all these community leaders are saying, we want public art, we want our communities to be a great place to live, and I was racking my brain. I was thinking, why doesn't our community leaders have grants proposed to these artists where there's living and working spaces for these artists that have like a 5-year contract or a 3-year contract, depending on what their art and what they're going to contribute to the city? I think that would benefit everyone. And the other thing I'd like to say is to the woman that suffered that tragedy, and the trauma that she's going through, I feel for you, and I hope that you get some help, you know, for the post-traumatic stress syndrome. I mean, this is a larger topic about how we as a community kind of honor our artists, honor our families, even families that are having difficulties living in places. If we want good communities, we have to make spaces for them.
Okay, well said. I'll let that stand, and I thank you for the call. Unless either Nihar or Sanuba wants to respond, but you may want to respond actually to a comment from Robert who says, urban arts colonies rely on the decay of economically distressed districts in order to flourish. The new users of the structures are those responsible for their safety operation. Some thoughts from either of you?
Well, while that is true, it's like our landlords have taken our money for almost a decade and not cared about our safety, but they did care about our money. So, I mean, I guess it is up to us, but that's just how capitalism works. To the woman before, there is some nonprofits that do offer grants and they have you sign like a 5-year lease or something, but unfortunately, a lot of the art we make is not recognized by institutions, and in that way we're kind of like making marginalized art. So then unless you're a nonprofit, they won't give you these types of grants. Unless you have 3 years of financials, they won't give you these types of grants. So a lot of us don't necessarily have that because we have not been fueled by like making money and keeping track of these things, because that's not why we do this.
Let me go back just for a moment before I go to more calls here, Nihar, to you. You lost 7 friends in that horrible fire. And now we've heard some of the music. I mean, it's important for, I guess, remembrance and for memorializing to have that music out there. So we've got the archives now, tracks?
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of different archival efforts, and there's a lot of efforts to try to generate new generations of artists going on within the community. One of the biggest archives of the Bay Area music scene is the Ratskin compilation that came out recently. It's actually over 12 hours of music that was mostly brought together right after the fire from primarily Bay Area artists, a lot of people that we lost in the fire, people that are friends or connected somehow to this community. And, you know, that compilation, it's an exceptional document. It really breaks the mold of how record labels usually operate, where they just sort of try to maximize, you know, influence and marketing for a specific release for one person. This is just like a massive archive of Bay Area things. You know, there's the work that my own label's doing, which has been mentioned. Catabatic has been, which used to sort of focus on underground parties here, but really can't operate that way anymore. Now is operating as a record label, and they've been putting out and are going to continue to put out things from Barrett Clark and other artists who we lost in the fire. You know, there's
Derek Almeida had his own art display, as I'm sure you know.
I'm very, very aware of that. And you know, that the community that of folks that lived in the warehouse and the people that were at the party were pretty separate in a lot of ways. But, you know, I don't like to think about artists as a separate community, even though there are certain characteristic ways you can think about that. Art is something we need to ensure is possible for everybody within our society to be able to practice in different ways. That's how it generates and grows, and that's how society evolves, you know. So a lot of the way I approach this is not about protecting a specific group of artists, which, you know, you might have a specific profile, but every, you know, teenager in Oakland High School should have a way to sort of break out of the isolation of and sort of share their creativity with other people. And I think that's the approach all of this should take. It should be about everyone.
Nihar Bhatt, again, is a DJ with the San Francisco Surface Tension Collective. And let me get another caller on here. And it's a caller from Oakland. Sadath, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, like, the fire had a much larger effect, not only in Oakland, but in the rest of the Bay Area and the rest of the country with artists getting displaced. I lived in a space called Burt Rahman in Richmond, and immediately after the fire, the mayor decided to hail us as Richmond's own version of Ghost Ship and published our address, leading to a very lengthy NOV and ultimately a red tag where the residents no longer are allowed to be inside the building. So what we've been doing is living outside of the building to protect it, because the neighborhood isn't exactly the safest, to ensure the building safety from squatters. And I think the fires brought up a lot of issues with how cities reacted in a really authoritarian way towards artist spaces, and I just wanted to bring that perspective up.
I thank you for that perspective. Appreciate it. And let me read another perspective here from a listener named Dan, who is actually a lieutenant, apparently, in the police fire department in Oakland. He writes, Mayor Libby Schaff needs to figure out what side she's on. You can't have it both ways. Employees need direction. As an example, my district encompasses the East 12th Street corridor of homeless encampments. The city apparently tolerates these. When I respond for a fire where someone is cooking or trying to keep warm, am I supposed to show zero tolerance and extinguish it? Or do I show compassion and let them cook and keep warm? Then a breeze kicks up, tents ignite, people die, and I get sued because my engine company responded 15 minutes earlier and didn't put out the fire. City employees need and deserve clear direction from code enforcers to the line firefighter on the street. Don't send us mixed signals. Let me go to more of your calls. Let's go next to Tom in Los Gatos. Tom, you're on.
Hey, good morning, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. I think the most efficient way to preserve artists' life integrity and their work and so on is just to have an adopt an artist program in Oakland and other big cities, where people with these large new houses that are art poor can invite young, vibrant artists into their home to design, interior design, exterior design, garden, and take care of the whole property so it becomes a magnet for the entire community. Everyone will want to go there and, you know, join the party. And also, this would, you know, prevent any further denigration of artists and other people's lifestyles in the inner city in these old buildings, which could just be, you know, demolished because they would no longer be needed and then rebuilt into modern apartments, condos, and so on. And also, of course, the building codes are really out of whack. The other caller, or I guess it was Michael, you said it's the government's responsibility to provide affordable housing. And what the government is doing is zoning up to 33 jobs per housing unit in cities, you know, like San Francisco. And
just a correction, Tom. That was from a comment that I read. But we did have Matthew Desmond on yesterday, and he was talking about the need for universal vouchers, and that's similar along the line of what you're talking about. And I appreciate hearing from you. Let me read a couple comments here. Anne writes, I just want to mention that the city of Sacramento provides live workspace for artists at Warehouse Artist Lofts on R Street in Midtown Sacramento. It ties in with Tom's call about what government can do or ought to do. Mel writes, I just wanted to thank the guests who lost friends and fellow artists in this tragedy for your hard work and persistence to make creative spaces and living spaces safer and for making our cities better places to live. You honor the lost lives and the memory of your friends very well. And let's bring on another caller, and that's Edwina. You're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to mention something really important, that there is a documentary, and it's the only one that I know of currently, that was made by my fellow bandmate, who we lost friends in the fire. And in the aftermath of the fire, he created an entire documentary by going around and interviewing survivors and going to underground places, just like the Burnt Ramen that was mentioned, and so many others in the Bay Area, and interviewing their owners and what's happened after the fire. And it also interviewed people who have seen this going on, local celebrities like Jello Biafra of the Dead Kennedys is featured in it, and this year's Grammy winner, Fantastic Negrito, is also in it. And it is showing around the Bay Area. It already premiered once, but in December it's showing three different times. And I can either give you those dates now, or I can direct you to the director's Facebook page, and all the info is on.
Well, you've got some competition, Edwina. There's somebody filming right as we're speaking here. There's a documentary filmmaker who's pointing a camera right at us now. But if you want to give out those dates, please go ahead.
Sure. It's called, the documentary is called Underground Under Review, A Ghost Ship Aftermath. And you can find all the info on Zach Bateman's Facebook page. That's just ZackBateman. It's playing this Sunday from 6 to 9 at the Hatch, Oakland, on 15th Street. It's playing on the 10th at the Gilman, and it's also playing at the 16th in the Independent Brewery in Oakland.
Okay,
and like
you got premier promotion there, and
there
thank you
go.
For that.
You're fantastic.
Okay, I just thought you was maybe going to mention one place. Let me get another caller on. Maureen joins us next. Maureen, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Michael. As a resident of San Francisco and a former resident of Oakland, I appreciate this whole affordability issue, but the onus of providing affordable housing should not be on the backs of individual landlords. With rent control, it's really hard to keep a building updated with property taxes and other maintenance issues. Also, you know, places like ghost ships not only put themselves at risk, they put the firefighters at risk, they also put other neighbors at risk by housing so many people in one place. I think the city should crack down on these places and, you know, make them up to code or do whatever, but it's a safety issue.
Let me ask either of you to respond to that, Nihar or Sanuba.
Can I just bring up that there are maybe multiple ideas of safety that are being discussed? Like, the city only talks about life safety, but for a lot of us, there is this other concept of safety where we, you know, have marginalized identities. We're queer, we're trans, we're people of color, and a lot of us maybe are ostracized from our families. So in a sense, like, having this community and being able to be ourselves and be free is safety, because it's no, like, it's common knowledge that greater society is pretty racist and, like, transphobic. So for us, being able to be ourselves and being able to make our art is the only reason we're alive. And that is safety. Our community is safety. So, and then there's also life safety. But the ghost ship, honestly, my warehouse, it was pretty safe. And there were two exits, and it's on a ground floor. And it would have been at my house had the city not already cracked down on us. We're being forced and more, like, forced further and further into these safer and unsafer spaces. We knew that space was unsafe. A lot of us didn't like going there, but it was the last place to throw shows. It was the last place for us to be able to do that.
Let me say on this anniversary, I hope you can find a safe place, and I hope you can thrive. And thank you so much for joining us. That's the Nuba Dream. Lee Harbat, thank you for joining us. Matthias Gaffney, the music you're hearing is a track called The Industrial City by Cherushi, the DJ name of Chelsea Dolan, who died in the fire. And this is from the album released this week called Run the Length of Your Wildness. Chefs.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.